an integral part of his persona. A very thought-provoking lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, Allah has explained himself. Nobody is a partner to him in his domain, might, and glory. He is eternal, has always been, and shall always be. He existed even before the universe came into being, but there is no beginning to his existence. He shall remain when every other thing shall vanish, and there shall be no end to his existence. His glory in his existence is so supreme, preeminent, transcendent, incomparable, and excellent that it is beyond the grasp of intellects. No one can understand or visualize him. When you have accepted these facts, then your behavior, so far as his commands are concerned, should be that of a person who realizes that his status, power, and position is nothing when compared to that of his Lord, who wants to gain his blessings through prayers and obedience, who fears his wrath as well as his punishments, and who absolutely in need of his help and protection. Remember, my son, Allah has not ordered you to do anything but that which is good and which propagates goodness, and He has not prohibited you from anything but that which is bad and will bring about bad effects.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and that is the universal aspect of his personality. One of the examples of how he treated non-Muslims, a person by the name of Ash-Shu'bi says once, Amir al-Mu'minin found that an armor that he had lost while he was traveling to Siffin He founded with a Christian in Kufa. Remember, he's Khalifa al-Muslimin. He's head of the Muslim empire of the time. So he goes to him and he says, you know, this is mine. And he says, no, this belongs to me. So Ali says, okay, let's go to the judge. Qazi Shuray, who was appointed by Amir al-Mu'mineen. Well, he was appointed in the previous administration, but Amir al-Mu'mineen maintained him in his position with certain conditions. And so Amir al-Mu'mineen takes this Christian subject of his own empire, and he is the, you know, ruler of the time, to the judge. وَجَلَسَ إِلَى جَانِبِهِ He goes to the Qazi and he sits beside this Christian. And then basically he told the judge, and this is where we see that he didn't say Qazi that because I'm Khalifa al-Muslimin, I am the head of the state here, give me a special seat. Maybe you sit here, I'll sit there. No, he was the judge, and Ali had gone there as a claimant with this person against whom he had the complaint. So he's sitting with him. And so he says, هَذَهِ دَرْعِي هَذَهِ دَرْعِي This is my armor. And the Christian says, مَا هِيَ إِلَّا دَرْعِي This is mine. Can you imagine saying to the ruler of the time, especially when there were no human rights tribunals, nothing about minorities and this and that, saying, this is mine? Where the ruler is claiming, this is mine? But one point here, very interesting, is that although this person was a Christian, lived among Muslims, all collectively in the Eastern society, when the language is there, it has some beauty which we lose in the West. He says in his claim, in his response to the Qazi, he says, this is mine, this is surely mine. وَلَمْ يُكَذِّبْ عَمِيرُ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ He says, I'm claiming this is mine, and I'm not saying that he is a liar. Look at the adab. Sometimes you can disagree with someone without insulting the person. Learn from this Christian that he is making a claim. They say, this is mine. When you say, this is mine, and Ali is saying, this is mine, by implication, you are na'uzu billah saying that he is lying. So you want to make your claim, but you do not want that, you know, label of lying be applied on him. So he says, this is mine, and I'm not saying that he is lying. Maybe he's, you know, he made a mistake in identifying the item. And this is something we have to learn when we talk about, even if we have differences among ourselves, be polite. Give this positive, you know, side of the judgment to the opponent, even though you disagree with that person in that matter. The judge appointed by Ali says to Ali, Alaka bayyina? Do you have a proof or a witness to say this is yours? And Amir al-Mu'mineen qala la wa huwa yadhhak. And Ali was smiling. He said, no, I don't have any evidence. No receipt from the, you know, buyer or any documentation on this issue. And so the judge says then, you know, you Nasrani, you go, this is yours. And they left the court. The Christian took the armor, and after moving away a few steps, the conscience comes in, hits in. He turns back and goes to Amir al-Mu'min and he says, Ashhadu anna hadhihi ahkam al-anbiya. I bear testimony that what I saw today are the rulings brought by the prophets of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He says, Amir al-Mu'mineen qaddamani ila qadhihi wa qadhihi yaqda alayh. He says, the chief of the believers takes me to a judge who is appointed by him, and the judge rules against him. This is where we see the sense of justice, and this is where he says, you know, this is definitely coming from the ahkam of the Anbiya. ثُمَّ أَسْلَمَ He became a Muslim there. It wasn't an issue of this armor that Ali was looking for. He became a Muslim. اعْتَرَفَ بَعَنَّ الدَّرْعَ سَقَطَتْ مِنْ عَلِي عِنْدَ مَصِيرِهِ إِلَى صِفِّينَ And he confessed that this was an armor which fell down from Ali's horse in his journey towards Siffin, and I picked it up later on. So he knew this was, you know, Ali's property. فَفَرِحَ عَلِيِّ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ بِإِسْلَامِهِ Imam became very pleased with his Islam, gave him the armor, plus, as a bonus, a horse with it. And this fellow became a companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen and fought alongside him against the Khawarij and became one of the shuhada in the way of Islam and in the way of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Thank you.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program, The Muslim Lady. This is your host, Zainab, and I have with me, Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
A very warm welcome, Siddiqa.
Thank you very much.
Dear listeners, Siddiqa is a student of jurisprudence in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom, and she's also a researcher. She researches a lot on the issues related to women. Well, we have this issue which is called as OCD in short, or shall I say obsessive compulsive disorder, a topic which is sometimes misunderstood or people have little information about that. I would want you to shed some light on that.
Okay. So first, the whole point of discussing it on a women's show is the reason I wanted to sort of look into this is because it is largely misunderstood, and especially in the Islamic world. And because it is misunderstood in the Islamic world, the services available are limited. It is misunderstood because it is a relatively new phenomena, and it's not something we've seen before in such large numbers as it is happening today. Now, given that I work with a lot of scholars from around the world as part of my other jobs, I keep on seeing a trend of people coming in with questions that they show symptoms of OCD, which is why it becomes so important to discuss it.
Yeah.
And how within an Islamic framework we can go about resolving these issues. Now, women generally, when it comes to OCD, A lot of women would see eating disorders as part of the OCD, but that's not all. First, I'll define OCD. So OCD is an obsessive compulsive disorder, which is now seen as a mental health issue, and it can severely affect a person's home life, relationship, daily life, and basically a person's day-to-day life becomes extremely hard. Now, OCD, there are different symptoms of it. Some of them are what, first, in the Islamic world. Now, when I mean Islamic world, I mean the scholars. The scholars I have come across, now here I'm stressing on who I have come across, and they just take it as doubts, like excessive washing, repeating your wudu several times, you know, repeating the namaz several times. They just place it under that category because...
The category of doubt.
Yes, because OCD is a disease that you would have to physically go through it to understand what it is. Otherwise, it becomes quite... It is a mental health issue. Now, some of the symptoms of OCD can be the fear of germs and contamination, which is what it's generally understood as by the scholars who I have come across. And then there are the much more worse forms. Some of them would be very intrusive thoughts. Intrusive thoughts about religion, intrusive thoughts about violence. Now, when I talk about this, I'll give an example of what I have seen.
So you completely differentiated it from the doubts, because yes, you came to thoughts now.
Yes. Now, what people generally understood OCD is as just doubts, or, you know, doing something constantly. Like, I remember one of my friends was like, I have OCD about cleaning my kitchen. I'm like, that's not OCD. You just need a clean kitchen, right?
Okay.
That's different. Now, that was her case, obviously. But then there's some people who, when it comes to germs and contamination, it's how we generally understand OCD is the minute they touch something, they need to go wash their hands, which is how OCD is generally understood as. But because there are other levels which can be very severely difficult to deal with, like thoughts.
Okay.
Now, for example...
Now it's becoming a little more interesting because you're getting deeper into the topic. We're actually understanding what it is. We would like to know more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm with Sadiqa and we're discussing about OCD. Yes, Sadiqa, you were actually explaining it you're throwing a deep, deep light into the issue.
So when it comes to, like we discussed, there's one level of fears of germs and contamination, and then it goes to the thoughts. Now, the thoughts, from what I've seen with people coming to us with, like I said, I work with a range of scholars who are quite... into the communities, and the questions that they get constantly, and I have seen this trend increasing within the Islamic world, is that people would say they have intrusive thoughts about, I'm sorry, I'm using a very graphic example, but it's only to get the message home.
Yeah.
Okay. Then they think that they are the ones who are wrong, that I have made a sin by thinking.
Okay.
Right? Generally, till now, from what I've read, psychologists have not really been able to pinpoint a specific cause for OCD. But because people have these intrusive thoughts, would have thoughts about violence towards themselves or others, or they would imagine themselves harming their family, even though they don't want to do it. It's not from themselves.
It's just
a thought. They do not put it into action.
Then they feel regretful towards their thoughts as well.
Yes, and then it becomes a cycle. The thought comes. And the funny thing about OCD is, and it is very, very difficult to handle, is that it is so intrusive that if you do not concede to it, it will not leave you. And this is what people go through when it comes to OCD. Until they do not concede to it in their mind, it will not leave them. And when they do concede to it, they feel this sense of relief in them. Then the guilt comes in.
Okay.
Then it's a chain. Then again, after again. And from what I've kind of understood is that people go through this OCD as a result of immense pressure in their lives, especially which is seen during the childhood years, either through assault, different forms of assault, growing up in households which were not very stable, mm-hmm. or just seeing intensive pressures in the childhood years.
Or any kind of trauma they went
through. Yeah, any trauma would then, to an extent, cause OCD. Now, in women, OCD is generally diagnosed a bit later.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they haven't really pinpointed, but it could be a reason that women do not openly speak about these issues so much faster.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it just starts to show itself later in women.
Now, since you yourself said that women do not speak about it themselves or they do not openly talk about it, what could be done about it? I'll ask you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
We're talking about OCD. Sudhika, we went through OCD. We differentiated it with doubts and we gave some Islamic examples. And now you came to women.
Yes. So there are other forms of OCD, but because I have come across the intrusive thoughts so much, and given that I do not feel that this part of OCD is openly discussed within the Islamic circles, and therefore I do feel that there's an importance for us to get it out and get people the help they need. Now, even these intrusive thoughts can sometimes be in the form of them doubting. They do not doubt the existence of Allah, right? But they doubt, their thoughts make them feel that they doubt the existence of Allah. It's a very hard,
difficult situation.
The situation for them.
Sometimes it may lead you to doubt your faith.
Yeah, they do not have doubts about Allah. They do not have any doubts in the faith.
But this they're feeling.
They're very religious people. But those thoughts, which are not, they do not align themselves to those thoughts. That's another thing. They do not feel those thoughts are coming from them. It is something that is within them that is coming in the form of an obsessive
compulsive
order,
disorder.
That is very difficult for them to separate from themselves. And because it is mental, they have to go about their daily life while having to deal with this. And at some point, they can't do it. And therefore, some people do go for suicide, which shows the extremity of this issue. So I had spoken to my teacher about it, right? My teacher is a teacher in jurisprudence. And I asked her about these issues. And her answer was simple. These thoughts, because it is a mental disorder, these thoughts do not entail any sin on the person. So if you go through these thoughts at any point, just know that you're not going to be sent for it.
It's okay.
Yes. But that does not mean that you should not get the help you need.
All right.
Right?
So there you go. You don't have to feel regretful about it. You have not committed a sin if a thought is just coming in. But at the same time, you need to seek help.
Yes. Because if a person does not seek help, it can be very lifelong. I know of people who've gone through this for 15 odd years. And later they were able to seek help. And the reason they went through it for 15 years was because they were afraid to speak of it, given that it is such a taboo subject. It is a subject that people do not discuss. And if a person is having anti-religious thoughts,
which
they do not align to themselves, but because they're so scared of speaking out about it, because people might say that these people have left their religion.
How can he think about it? How can she think about it?
Exactly. And they're so scared of speaking about it that they don't speak about it. And then the issue goes on for many years, and the help that they could have easily gotten is the chance is lost, basically. So, yes, just making sure that the help is got. And there are different helps available, which we can discuss.
Thank you. All right, so any anti-religious thought coming into your mind and you're not speaking about it openly can actually lead into problems. You should speak about it, seek help.
Seek
from
help
a counselor.
From counselors, yes. All that's right. One way of seeking help.
So what do you do with women over here?
Okay, so the methods of getting help for OCD, one of them is going to a psychologist or a counselor. I would recommend an Islamic counselor who's able to help you get through, especially if those issues are religious-based. It would be helpful to go through an Islamic psychologist or a counselor who's able to walk you through methods of containing these thoughts such that they do not overly burden your life. And then there are other methods. Some of them are like meditation. Meditation has seemed to help a few people who I know. I'm talking about an Islamic form of meditation over here. When they're doing yoga, they utter the term Om, which is a Hindu god.
Yeah.
But an Islamic form of meditation, it is a meditation which is you relax the mind, but it also by uttering the word Allah. So bringing that focus within yourself towards Allah to bring the mind some calm and peace.
All right. Thank you so much, Siddiqa, for being with us. Thank you so much for explaining actually what OCD is. Now in another session, we'd like to continue and give more examples from women, basically. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the love one?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illa Allah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iran is no stranger to the handwoven carpet market. Traditionally, the country has been weaving carpets for millennia with skills passed down through generations, some even as highly protected family secrets. Iranians were among the pioneers of weaving carpets, and with years of experience, they have achieved a great deal of perfection in this arena. The craft has represented Iran's rich culture and heritage for centuries and has been adored all over the world. Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. Today we are going to explore Iran's handwoven carpet market. We wanted to see why these carpets are highly coveted and what makes them so expensive. Plus, we will look at some of this sector's contributions to Iranian culture and the national economy. So, stay with us and let's roll out the show. Thank you. Our quest for answers led us to the 29th International Exhibition of Handmade Iranian Carpets. This event is viewed by many industry participants as the world's largest handmade carpet expo when it comes to quantity and quality. Visitors were dazzled by thousands of handwoven carpets in all sorts of contemporary and traditional design patterns. The exhibition is a place for national and international trade and commercial envoys to visit in order to size up the market and make business deals. All sorts of carpets are found here that were brought in from all corners of Iran, including very rare rugs. We caught up with a few vendors to see what type of activities they carry out. A high-quality Iranian carpet can cost thousands of dollars, with antique rugs fetching even higher prices. There is so much variety to choose from the floral designs of Isfahan to the intricate fine details of Qom carpets and the strong, compact Bijar rugs made in western Kurdish villages. The list goes on and on. However, most carpets are not valued based on knot count, but rather because of their materials, design, and overall size. While some rug varieties follow specific designs, most are entirely improvised, with the weaver adding traditional motifs and their personal design touch to the carpet. Handwoven with the finest materials, including wool and silk, a single Persian rug can often take years and sometimes decades to create. Most handwoven carpets are produced in rural areas. Furthermore, women make up the majority of carpet weavers and produce raw materials such as silk and wool in rural areas. Such collectives safeguard the rights and income of weavers who frequently receive the least profit from their products. This is mainly due to numerous middlemen businesses that make money from carpets. Cooperatives also serve another purpose. They organize the production chain by linking material producers with weavers and buyers to complete a production cycle. The massive exhibition is one of the best places to get a bird's eye view of this thriving market. Yes, ironically, one of the biggest importers of Iranian handmade carpets used to be the United States. This is followed by European countries. However, owing to the U.S.-imposed sanctions, Americans were forced to find alternate avenues to satisfy their cravings for these highly coveted carpets. For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented the country's rich culture and art. Its stunning design and exquisite quality have turned the ancient craft into a lucrative commodity sought after by many across the world. But Iran's handwoven carpet exports have also seen numerous ups and downs over the decades. Industry participants say the U.S. sanctions tried to pull the rug out from under the Persian carpet legacy. But the move didn't work and only seems to have increased the world's demand for these items. 1994 was the golden period for Iranian handwoven carpet exports. Back then, exports peaked at over $2 billion. Later down the road, the U.S. imposed a ban on Persian rugs in 2010. After signing a 2015 nuclear deal, the ban was lifted only to be reimposed after Washington unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018. That's also around the time when cheap knockoffs of Persian rugs made by Asian countries began flooding the market. Either way, authentic handwoven rugs from Iran still hold their place in the market despite roller coaster exports. The industry is gradually bouncing back. According to Iran's Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture, the country still maintains first place in exports of handwoven carpets worldwide. Based on figures from the National Customs Administration, exports of handwoven carpets increased to nearly 85% in terms of value in the first 2 months of 2021 alone. According to the National Carpet Center of Iran, last year, the country exported some $64 million worth of these items. Also, production went up after the coronavirus pandemic as many craftspeople who had left the sector returned, causing a production jump of around 400%. No matter where you're from or who you are, one thing that brings people together is a good meal. Everyone has a favorite food. It's a great way to connect with others, experience culture, and explore new flavors. And the food industry caters to our tastes, which is the main driver for the expansion of this sector. The food industry is made up of a complex network of activities related to farming, production, supply, and a host of services and products. So it's no surprise that this sector also plays a significant role in the economic development of any nation. We wanted to learn more about the journey meat products take to finally reach grocery store shelves and dinner tables. So to become more familiar with food production, we visited a meatpacking business on the outskirts of the capital, Tehran. This particular producer was established 15 years ago and has become a familiar name in the industry. The meatpacking market is composed of many sectors within the market. One of the primary concerns for any company packaging meat is the ability to deliver fresh products to consumers. This can happen in various ways and is heavily dependent on the type of meat that will be packaged. For example, this company has several production halls dedicated explicitly to particular activities because not all meat comes in the same size or can be handled with the same machine. There are different production halls for each meat type. Red meats, such as lamb and cow, require larger machines and more space, while poultry, such as chicken, require smaller machines comprising closed-circuit production lines. But why does this company use a closed-circuit production line? This ensures the meat passing through each stage is kept cool and free of foreign contaminants. More importantly, such a process guarantees that each item is uniformly cut and packaged while maintaining sanitary conditions crucial for quality and safety. Now, the modern food industry uses a wide variety of sophisticated technologies, making production more efficient. It has also reduced menial human labor, freeing up hands for other, more complex tasks. In case you didn't know, and many don't, Iran has indigenized a lot of technology and machinery needed in the food industry. Moreover, these machines play a crucial role in maintaining food quality and safety. For most companies in the food industry, the high quality output is deeply hinged on the raw material they use. In the case of this company, they use free-range livestock that is pasture-fed from some of the most famous animal-rearing regions of the country. While most meatpacking companies have their own slaughterhouses, this one maintains contracts with livestock farmers who slaughter the animals before sending them to the packing company. The food industry is one of the most heavily regulated sectors in the nation. That is because quality and safety are important aspects for consumers. This company makes its products along the lines of Iran's Food and Drug Administration guidelines and the National Standards Bureau. It has also received international certificates for production and safety, meaning it can easily export its products too. Additionally, this company has created numerous job opportunities for the community while maintaining the highest production standards. What makes a company stand out among others in this highly competitive industry is not only the quality of products, but also the services it provides to its consumers. While the food industry has not been directly sanctioned by the United States, these harsh measures have hindered international banking and money transfers. This means many in this sector cannot import important machine components, which are still not locally manufactured.
The basis of the food industry has always been agricultural production. Without the output of this sector, the food industry would not thrive as it does now. That's why Iran has a very robust agrarian industry. But agriculture is not limited to farming alone. It also includes livestock rearing, dairy, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. Plus, exports from this strategic industry have also generated millions in foreign revenues, contributing to the national economy.
First, let's look at the country's meat production as a whole. Based on the National Livestock Exporters Assembly, domestic needs for red meat roughly stands at 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, the country had 72 million heads of these animals, meaning 12 million were surplus and could be used for various exports. According to official figures, this year, 51,000 tons of red meat were produced up to the month of May alone. However, not all livestock are raised for their meat. They are also used for dairy production. Looking at statistics from Iran's Customs Administration, roughly $800 million of raw milk is exported annually. Next, we have the agriculture sector, which mainly produces raw materials for other food production. Data from the Customs Administration shows that some 7 million tons of agricultural and food products were exported last year. This amount was worth nearly $5 billion and reveals an 8% growth in export values compared to 2020. Looking more closely at these exports, around half of this revenue was raked in by 10 major agricultural products. The undisputed king of all agricultural exports is saffron, which brought $1 billion in trade. Next came pistachios, valued at $540 million, followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of value.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here for the first time on Bazaar. The process that we are checking out today is called plating. Well, it's not actually called plating, it's just very similar to plating. I just thought that that's the name that you had heard. It's actually called PVD, or physical vapor deposition. But it's similar to plating in that it's essentially adding a layer of metal on a material, maybe to harden it, maybe to for decorative purposes, but mostly for decorative purposes. So this is the process that we're checking out today in this edition of Bazaar.
The company we're checking out today started their journey by producing microelectronic parts such as vacuum pumps, vacuum tubes, pressure sensors, and the likes, but they quickly realized that a better way to implement the tools that they're manufacturing is to actually use the parts to assemble a machine to do coating in a much more sophisticated way rather than selling the individual parts. They found a much better market making those machines and getting clients to coat various objects and materials in their machines, or even selling the machine itself to clients so they can run a coating business themselves.
So, the application can be used in tiles and ceramics, faucets and other kitchen and bathroom appliances, kitchen utensils, bowls, also kitchen utensils, and decorative items such as these three vases and also crystal. Now, the different colors are achieved using different combinations of titanium. If it's a combination of titanium with nitrogen in the form of a gas, you get the gold-looking color, which is applied on crystal, has this kind of matte texture to it. And the rose gold color is a combination of titanium, nitrogen, as well as aluminum. The black one, well, the shiny black one, is a titanium, nitrogen, aluminum, and carbon. So, and of course, the last one, the crystal, which has this like tint of rose gold, it is achieved using a completely different material, chromium. But now let's talk about some of the processes that went behind to get this company to this place that they are able to make these items.
Here's how the process works. Once the objects we want to coat are loaded into the chamber, blocks of titanium are loaded onto the cathodes. The anode is the entire chamber itself. Through small holes in a pipe inside the chamber, argon, a neutral gas, is injected. Argon is the preferred gas for the process because it doesn't chemically react with either our titanium block or the loaded material. At this point, the chamber is turned into a vacuum chamber to allow for the gas to flow more easily in it. The argon is ionized, so it moves towards the cathodes that have the block of titanium on them. And it moves at such a speed that it vaporizes the titanium. And now the titanium in the gaseous form is ready and primed to sit on our material in the chamber, especially since the particles of the material have expanded due to high temperature in the chamber, making it easy for the titanium atoms to go and sit in between the particles and stick to it easily after they've been taken out of the chamber at room temperature after cooling down.
When you see the zapping, that's when the titanium atoms are sticking to the surface of the chair, or when the coating is happening. It's the physical deposition of the vapors, as the technical term suggests. But there is one missing link here. So what we put in the chairs that we put inside the chamber, they had an unappealing silver tint to them. And now when they're going to come out, they're going to have a gold coating on them. But here's the thing, the missing link is that the titanium block can only give you a silver shine, right? But the gold shine is not just with the titanium block. If you want to get the gold shine out of it, you're going to have to add nitrogen into the mix too. So through the same pipe that the argon is injected into the chamber, nitrogen in the form of gaseous is also injected into the chamber. And that nitrogen, once it is connected, once it reacts with the titanium, you get that gold tint. And now they're going to open up the chamber. So they were waiting for the air pressure to come back to a stable level because there was vacuum in there. And if they just open up the chamber when there's vacuum in it, that's not going to be good. So there's the gold tint on your silver chairs. And the gold, of course, is the combination of titanium and nitrogen. There you go.
In every part of the world, decor takes a different shape. What people spend money on to make their houses look good is different. Gold has always had a special place in Iran, which makes it understandable that we, perhaps more than the average person in a lot of other countries, would like to have ornaments that have that shine, just without breaking the bank.
Us humans love shiny things. We tend to value them more highly than their non-shiny counterparts. But, you know, gold tends to be a little bit more expensive than, titanium or pretty much any other metal. So because we can't have something this big that is made out of actual gold that shines, we do the next best thing. We coat it in gold, aka titanium and nitrogen. Personally, though, I prefer things to be more matte, but that's just personal preference. But obviously, there's a market for these shiny ornaments and furniture and candlesticks. So whether it's a gold shine or a silver shine that you're looking for, I think now you have a much better idea of where these things get their shine from. But anyways, thank you for staying tuned for another edition of The Bazaar.
We're getting close to the end of the program, but before we go, let's take a look at some news and trends in the country's carpet and textile industry. Persian handwoven carpets are some of the world's oldest, most valuable rugs, but watch out, there are scores of counterfeit ones too. That's why these carpets are registered with the World Intellectual Property Organization. The head of the National Carpet Center, Farahnaz Rafe, says Iran's handwoven carpets are registered with the WIPO badge. Rafe describes the global registration for handwoven carpets as a move towards preserving and protecting this original art industry. These rugs will now be exported with the WIPO badge. Also, other ways to spot an authentic Persian carpet are through its handwoven knots, which are tighter and more delicate. Another method of identifying authenticity is the choice of materials like wool and silk used in the carpets or by pinning down its regional design. In other news, Iranian artisans have handwoven a unique rug in anticipation of the famous FIFA World Cup event this year hosted by Qatar. The carpet's intricate design incorporates flags of participating World Cup teams and top figures from the world of football, as well as information about Qatar. The master weavers are two brothers from the city of Tabriz. They say they used 70% silk and the remaining a combination of wool and silk. The carpet was created with over 2 million knots, measuring roughly 2 square meters, and was woven in 34 months. The work of art was unveiled during a ceremony in Qatar's capital city, Doha, earlier in the summer. It will be displayed throughout the competition for all to see this October. Carpets can be breeding grounds for all sorts of unwanted allergens. So, Iranian scientists have created a special nano antibacterial coating for carpet fibers, which has become quite popular recently. These carpets use a material containing silver nanoparticles, which can kill over 600 types of bacterial species. The antimicrobial protection prevents the growth of mold, dust mites, and other allergens. Originally, these types of carpets were released into the market roughly 3 years ago and are currently exported. In 2019, exports of antibacterial carpets stood at $2 million. These items are mainly sent to neighboring countries, Russia, South Africa, and some in Europe. That covers our program for today. Thanks for tuning in this week. It's bye for now.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatih al-Hayat. I am your host, Abdullah al-Musawi. We are talking about the second key to life, which is to learn. When it comes to learning, there are adequates that we need to maintain when it comes to learn. So there are manners when it comes to food. There are manners to greeting people. When it comes to learning, it's also there are manners that we need to observe when it comes to learning. First of which, we need to take knowledge in from the right places and the right people. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, he says, طَلَبُ الْعِلْمِ فَرِيضَةٌ عَلَىٰ كُلِّ مُسْلِمٍ. Seeking knowledge is actually compulsory upon every Muslim. That's one. Then he says, فَطْلُبُوهُ مِنْ مَظَانِّهِ. Seek knowledge from the right places. وَاقْتَبِسُوهُ مِنْ أَهْلِهِ. And take it from the right people. Because it's a place that teaches, because it's a person that teaches, it doesn't make them qualified. It doesn't make it the right place to study. We have many Islamic schools in the Muslim world, but what they teach is very destructive. They think they are teaching Islam and theology, but what they teach is they teach people to put a vest on their chests and go to other parts of the Muslim world and blow themselves up, thinking that they will go to heaven. Now, that's a place I should avoid, and those are the people I need to avoid. So when it comes to seeking knowledge, the first thing I must do is to make sure that I go to the right place that teaches the right things, that has the appropriate qualified instructors and teachers, not anyone, because that definitely will misguide me. Any person that has a way of talking could misguide me easily. And the hadith from the Ahl Bayt says, whoever listens to a speaker, if the speaker speaks about Allah, obviously correctly, he is as if he's listening to Allah. And if he listens to a person who deviates people from Allah, he is as good as listening to the shaitan. So me and you, we have to be very, very careful. From the will that being given by Dhulqarnain, he says, لا تتعلم العلم ممن لم ينتفع به. Do not seek knowledge from those who they themselves do not benefit from. فإنما لم ينفعه علمه لا ينفعك. For he who his knowledge does not benefit him is not going to benefit you. We see a lot of people, a lot of speakers, a lot of preachers. They talk about do this and do that. This is good. This is that. But they themselves do not practice what they preach. These people we should avoid, because if this knowledge did not benefit it,
themselves, how will it benefit me and you? So we need to go to a person who is knowledgeable and at the same time, عامل, عالم وعامل. He knows and he practices. Those are the people that what they teach me will have an effect on me. It will make a change in my life. Even when the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, he was asked to instruct the child not to eat dates, he had to stop eating dates for a while. Then he instructed the child not to eat dates. He said, well, first I need to apply before I preach. Let us take a short break, then we continue right after.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat. So when we talk about the etiquettes and the manners of learning, we said one, first we have to make sure we take it from the right places, the right people, the right sources. Two, when it comes to learning, one needs to have patience and perseverance because knowledge does not come easy. There are things need to be done. I need to wake up in the morning, for example. I need to go far places. I need to take transport. I need money. I need a lot of things. So there are hardships that comes with seeking knowledge. Unless I have the patience to do so, then I won't move any further. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, he says, "Man lam yasbir ala dhilli ta'allum." He who is not patient when it comes to the humbleness of seeking knowledge for 1 hour, بَقِيَ فِي ذِلِ الْجَهْلِ أَبَدًا. He will remain in the humility of ignorance forever. So sometimes I need to learn to be as patient as I can. Otherwise, I will not learn anything. So that path of learning obviously is not easy. That's why we see a lot of people when they try to learn, they fail and they move nowhere. Three, when it comes to the adequates of learning, is one, we say, لَا حَيَاءَ فِي الْعِلْمِ. There is no shame in trying to seek knowledge, or at least no embarrassment in trying to seek knowledge. Imam Rida alayhi salam, he says, لَا يَسْتَحِي أَحَدَكُمْ إِذَا لَمْ يَعْلَمْ أَنْ يَتَعَلَّمْ. He says, do not be embarrassed. Do not be ashamed that if you don't know, you go learn. And that's one of the biggest problems that we have these days. People who don't know and they act as if they know. That's a problem. If I don't know, it is not a shame. It is not embarrassing for me to say I don't know. I have to go learn. As simple as that.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
And number three, when it comes to the adequacy of learning, is that sometimes I have to be, as we call it, flattery to a person in order for him to teach me. Some people, you ask them to teach you something and they